Welcome to the Holy Shit Podcast. Frank and Patsy get together to discuss the issues of the moment. You know, the things that make you say, holy shit. Here are your hosts, Master Hapkidoist, Patsy Zarilla, and Attorney Frank Natel, Esquire.
A filled room of 9/11 first responders, and in front of me, a nearly empty Congress.
Witnesses may be seated.
And I'm sorry if I sound angry and undiplomatic, but I'm angry, and you should be too, and they're all angry as well. This should be flipped. This hearing should be flipped. These men and women should be up on that stage, and Congress should be down here answering their questions as to why this is so damn hard and takes so damn long. And you can end it tomorrow. Why this bill isn't unanimous consent and a standalone issue is beyond my comprehension. They did their jobs. Courage, grace, tenacity, humility. 18 years later, do yours.
Wow, Frank. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Holy Shit. And if you ever needed to hear a holy shit moment, that was it. That was John Stewart yesterday in front of Congress, in front of a committee in Congress, an appropriations committee, basically rebuking Congress over the 9/11 fund that is basically being cast aside. That was probably the most passionate speech I've ever seen a male human being, a man, give in front of Congress. This was a very hurt, very angry, frustrated person. And I think that's a big reflection of what all of us are feeling when it comes to Congress these days. Frank, that was probably your first time hearing that. What did you think?
You know, I have a lot to go through my head. Definitely, you know, taken aback by the fact that it takes, you know, today in, you know, 2019, it takes people that have some stature, some voice, to give voice to people who, you know, sacrificed a lot for other people. And, you know, it's a shame that we even have to have those kind of impassioned speeches given. And it's a shame to me, you know, as I sit here and think that there's cynical people out there that will find a reason to, you know, skewer the messenger, say that he's a celebrity and that he's grandstanding. But, you know, this is obviously an issue that's near and dear to him. And he's been on this issue for years and years. And he's a New Yorker. He cares about New Yorkers. He cares about this issue. It's clear he cares about it. Those are things that are running through my mind. And it also, it amazes me that, you know, that we live in, it reminds me of being like the Colosseum days in the Roman Empire, where all this other crap is going on that doesn't make any sense, that doesn't amount to anything in reality. Like there's no substance to a lot of the stuff that goes on in you know, the media and what runs the discourse of what you hear on the media and in the news and what comes across our screens every day, you know. But this is something of substance. There's people whose lives have changed, clearly, who are affected directly. And why isn't it something that's being taken care of? It stuns me. It stunned me to hear that. I just kind of sat back in my chair and like exhaled for a second because I was like taken aback from thinking this is still where we are, you know. That's what came to my mind.
You know, if you get a chance, you really should watch it. The whole thing is, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 minutes long, but you can find, you know, truncated little snippets. And the biggest part, the thing that got me the most, I think, maybe was, you know how, like, whenever you're in front of the congressional committees, they kind of sit, like, up on this, it's almost like they're on top of a wall, right? And, you know, maybe there's two rows of them, maybe an upper row and a lower row and whatever. And then you're, like, in like, normal chairs, you know, in a just tables and chairs. The committee seats were more than half empty.
Wow.
They were more than half empty, Frank. It was very, very sad to see. You know, it really was.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. It was very hard. It was very hard to watch that. But to see somebody as passionate as he is with this, you know, in a way, kind of gives you a little bit of hope, right? It's like, okay, there are good people out here. There are good folks, and yeah, you can say this was a celebrity grandstanding, and you made a good point with that. But somebody has to, right? These, you have people who risk their lives and are dying. All these clowns are playing this game and then don't even bother to show up. You know, it should not be that way. It really shouldn't.
No, not at all.
That was what I thought was just an absolutely incredible moment. Before we get any further into it, how was your week?
Yeah, this week's been amazing. You know, just on a personal level, we finished our regular season and the soccer season for my son's travel team and the crew that plays with him, and we had a really nice nice end of the season. The kids developed really nicely, and you know, obviously, winning games is fun, but you know, the development of the kids as human beings and as teammates is really what's foremost. And I, yes, we won at the end, but seeing them all develop into good little men is what I was really appreciating. And we all went out for post game ice cream, and just the smiles of the kids and the way they were playing with, you know, just playing, enjoying the day. It just, mm-hmm. It brings a smile to your face, and it makes you remember that there's also other important things going on in your world that, you know, really are the most important things, right? Your family and your kids. Thinking about those kind of things reminds you that, you know, these issues that we dwell on sometimes, there's a reason why we dwell on them, because we want our kids to have this great future, and we see this great future ahead of them, and we want to preserve it for them. But, you know, that was a fun thing for me this week. And also just, you know, just cracking along with some work and planning some summer vacation that's coming up soon. So it's been a great week. How about you?
Yep.
How's your week been?
You know what? It's been a, it was a good week. It really was. Students are doing well. You know, we're starting to get a couple of our adults a little bit more. We're starting to challenge them a little bit more, so they're starting to get into like their what a lot of people would consider like their intermediate belts, you know, blue, purple, you know, that area, red. So they're starting to come around a little bit. We're starting to challenge them a little bit more, and they seem to be responding pretty nice, you know. So that was nice to see. Other than that, just typical work and you know, all the rigmarole that goes along with that. Speaking of jobs, let's talk for a couple minutes about Nancy Pelosi and her job. And you made a pretty good point before we got on air about how you and I were talking. Sometimes it was you know, during the pod, sometimes it was just whenever we would get together or whatever, about her approach to impeachment and how that's going. So why don't you kind of take the lead on this a little bit?
Yeah. So, like, you know, it's funny how our podcast, I think, has become really a series. We didn't intend it this way, but we hearken back to a lot of things we've done in the past. And this is one of the things, you know, I think our very last podcast last Wednesday, we were both kind of, I wouldn't say debating, but going a little bit back and forth about where we thought, you know, Nancy Pelosi's direction on this was. And I think you were feeling rightly so. You were feeling a little jaded about, you know, what her plan was and her intention around how to handle the apparent misdeeds of our president. And I was feeling like, you know, she's got to have some plan, and maybe it's not apparent to us. And the question was, how does she maneuver that issue of the misdeeds of the president and basically hold on to power both within Congress and also as in her own position? Because we know that there was a blue wave last election, and part of that blue wave was, we want progressives, we want people who are going to get things done. So, you know, I think right after that podcast, maybe a day later or two, a statement that was attributed to Nancy Pelosi was, she said, I don't want to see Trump impeached. I want to see him in jail. And, you know, it's a soundbite moment to me. You know, we have these soundbite moments in politics, and that was a soundbite moment, because look through the statement and think about what that means. I think that what she's saying is, if you bring up impeachment charges, and she went into more in depth, and we'll talk a little bit about that here in a second, but you bring him up on impeachment charges, you start the impeachment process, where is it going to go? I mean, and we can argue about that. And I'm of the mind still, Master Patsy, that I'd like to see it go forward, because I think that it ultimately damages him. But there are those who think that if the impeachment process is started and that the Republicans in Senate stonewall it, and he survives that politically, that it will embolden him and strengthen him to the point where he can go into the next election and say, look, they not only wasted all your money with this investigation, but they wasted everybody's time without doing legislation and focused on this impeachment process, and it came to nothing. So let's send them a message and get everybody out of there and put my party in power, keep me in power. And that really, is a possibility that could be used in that way. And I can see why there's a concern around that. So what I think her theory is if you don't start that process, but you have investigations, you have hearings about what's going on, you subpoena Mueller and you subpoena records and you continue to investigate him, the American public, as we talked a little bit about last week, will feel like, well, it's up to us to do this job. And they came out in 2018 to do a job and send a message. They were angry. It was a response to what was going on in the country. And I think that anger will carry over. And then if he is not elected in 2020, he will be subject to criminal indictment under the cases that could be brought against him. Now, the indemnity or the immunity that he would have from being the president will be removed. So, i.e., he would be subject to possibly going to jail. So I can see where her strategy is. It does ruffle feathers, because there's a constitutional duty to move forward with this, regardless of what your political process is, what you think about the political outcome. It's not about the political outcome. It's about doing the right thing. And that's where, you know, it's going to be a difficult navigation through this decision-making. And I think ultimately, I still believe that, you know, she made another statement. She said, you know, he's committing impeachable offenses every day at one point. And he may leave them no choice but to bring those types of proceedings. And he may slip up enough with the Republican support base that he has that it won't be a political detriment to bring impeachment proceedings. So we'll see how it all plays out. But I see a little bit more into the insight of her strategy when she makes statements like, I don't want to see him impeached. I want to see him in jail.
Yeah, you know, I found that telling. I also think that, you know, we're a lot of folks, especially folks who claim to follow this a little bit, are what they're not talking about is you can only do what you can do in your house, right? So Nancy Pelosi can only do what she can do in the House of Representatives. That's it. That's the only power she has. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I'm just that's her limits of power. That's it, right? She's got the House. That's the only thing that she can directly affect, but she can indirectly affect the Senate, because if all of this is so overwhelming against Trump, and it all comes out, and everybody sees it for what it is, and the Senate refuses to move on what is damning, overwhelming evidence. And, you know, let's be honest, we're not talking about a blowjob in the Oval Office, right? We're talking about treasonous, criminal, high crimes and misdemeanors. The senators and Mitch McConnell, who is up for election this year, if they stonewall this could come back and bite them in the ass. So I guess my question is, why would you not want this to go forward and force these folks now? Because if when you don't, whenever you kind of, you know, slow roll this thing along, or you kind of hem-haw around, or you do whatever it is that they're doing, you're giving them shade. You're allowing them to continue to do their thing instead of shining a light on what's going on and forcing these people to come out from under the rock and actually do something.
I agree. And that's the danger, is that you almost look as if you're afraid to act because of the political consequences. Uh-huh. Whereas I think the fear should be on the other side, because if you do something so egregious, i.e. you fail to act on the evidence in front of you, then you're going to be subject to the wrath of the American people. And I think that's where they do need to put the pressure on. I agree with you. They need to put the pressure on the Republicans to go ahead and do the right thing or the wrong thing.
Right. And just do your thing, right? I mean, just go ahead and just do your thing and never really formally address that, you know, okay, because we want the Senate Republicans to act, you know, we want to see what they're going to do. Don't even mention that. That never actually happens, right? Just ignore it like it never happened, and just force them to do something now. Because Mitch McConnell came out and said that he's never going to allow this thing on the floor. Well, what happens whenever you almost, or as close as you can possibly get, are sitting there with a smoking gun? What's he do then? Does he still refuse to put it on the floor? Well, you got to figure that's a death sentence for
him. Yeah, politically, the shift then happens where he's going to be under the microscope.
Yeah. And this guy has never governed, right? I mean, it's very easy to just continuously say no and stonewall and you know, make easy decisions for himself and for his party. It's another thing to make the hard decisions for your country. He's never been able to do that. And I don't know if he has the ability to do it. He certainly doesn't have the strength to do it. I mean, you know, the internal strength, you know, the strength that you have as a human being. He certainly has shown he doesn't have that. So I'm curious, whenever he finally gets to the point where he can't duck anything, he can't hide anything, he has to, for lack of a better term, now he has to man up. What's he going to do? Right? What's he going to do? And I think that the Democrats are making it a little bit too easy on him. I really do.
Well, we'll see, because we also know that, as we've alluded to, Representative Jerry Nadler has indicated that, and again, talking about a series here, you asked a very poignant question about a month or so ago. When do I think we'll see Mueller? Do I think we'll see Mueller? And when do I think we'll see Mueller testify in front of Congress? And, you know, I think back at that time, I said probably before the fall, you know, probably sometime in the fall or before the fall. And I thought we would, in fact, see him. Just yesterday, Jerry Nadler, Representative Jerry Nadler, said, we're going to see Mueller testify, and it'll probably be before the end of the summer. And he indicated there may not even be a need for a subpoena, but if they need one, they will issue one.
Yeah, you and I had talked about this whole subpoena thing, and sometimes you know, it really serves the person you're issuing the subpoena to. It really serves them very well. because they may be in a position where maybe they want to testify, and I don't think that's the case with Mueller. I really don't think he wants to. I think he flat out said he didn't want to. But you got like Deutsche Bank, who was begging for a subpoena, right? Just so they can tell you what was going on. So some, you know, subpoenas sometimes gets a bad rap. It's not necessarily a bad thing a lot of times. Jerry Nadler seems to be the type of person, though, and this is the thing that I think is frustrating a lot of people, is he says something that seems very forceful and very forceful. And then he turns around and backs off. For example, you know, he allowed Barr. They came to an agreement with Barr to get some of the documents. After he said, "Well, you know what? We're just going to hold you in contempt." Then all of a sudden there was an agreement made. That kind of bothers me, because if you're willing to make the agreement, don't sit there and say we're just going to hold you in contempt. But he did. And then after they come to this agreement where they're going to get certain information, they didn't say what it was, and it's probably a good thing. We shouldn't, you know, we don't need to know that yet. We find out that Barr is going to run it past the White House first. Right? So it just, this continuous bullshit just keeps going, keeps circling around, and they keep letting these guys get away with it. It's like, okay, you're going to do this? Okay, fine, go ahead. And then, you know, they stab you in the back, and then they say, okay, well, you're going to do that? Okay, and then they stab you in the back again. And it's like this thing never ends. There has to come a point where you either, again, like we said about McConnell, man up, you know, shit or get off the pot, or you just allow, you just look weak and you continuously allow these guys to walk all over you. And Nadler, I think, is getting to that point where he's got to start showing some force and some authority.
Well, yeah, and I know that this is all true, and I think that, you know, you have a standard that, again, you know, you talked about this. I'm going to compare and analogize something you said before. You said that, you know, with the Democratic presidential candidates, we hold them to a purity test. Yep. With Republicans, they don't care, right?
Right.
Because if they're sexist, racist, whatever, all the better. But yeah, with us, with the Democrats, so to speak, we want them to be 100% pure from day one till now, till they run. We don't want to see anything in their past that says that they were ever unenlightened as to any of the issues around sexism, racism, ageism, you know, yeah, anything.
Anything.
So, but look, we also have a country that the rules have changed so much. And this is what Trump and his cronies wanted. They want to tear down everything. But they want to tear it down not for the good of the common person, which is what I think appealed to the common person when they voted for him. Those that did, you know, they thought we're going to tear down this terrible bureaucracy and this institution that holds down the little guy. Trump's going to be one that does that. It's going to benefit us. Well, clearly that hasn't happened. But the bottom line is, you know, the rules have changed, and there's still some people who are playing by the old rules, which is there's a process, right? There's a mm-hmm. process. We go through a process to, you know, subpoena things, to investigate, to have probable cause, to prove, you know, guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, to go through the channels, through the courts, to do everything that you're supposed to do the way you're supposed to do it. Parliamentary procedure. Okay, so we have that, and as people who want action today, yesterday, we say, screw that, man. You know, like, look what you're dealing with. You're dealing with people who don't play by the rules. So we want you not to play by the rules, you know? And that's a tough thing, because when you want the rule of law enforced, you have to play by the rule of law. Now, I'm not saying that you come out and you say, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, and then you don't do it. But I think you come out and you say, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. It's the same thing a lot of times in a negotiation or in a legal battle. You present a certain front, and then you utilize that in negotiation, and you see how far it'll get you without having to actually act upon it. Because just like in the art of war, you know, you can threaten war all you want, but once you actually are in the war, it's going to cost you a lot. It's going to cost you resources. It's going to cost you manpower. It's going to cost you, you know, in the future, even if you quote unquote win the war, it costs you something. It costs you to maybe rebuild your enemy's territory or to do something to bring, you know, your wounded home and to take care of them after that process. So in every little exchange, there is a price to pay. And the question is, at what point do you diminish those returns by continuing to, you know, front, so to speak, which maybe Jerry Nadler is doing at times. Maybe he's fronting with a certain sense of power and then backing off because he hopes to get what he wants without actually going into full battle. So, you know, at what point in time does he have to, quote unquote, man up and go into the battle?
Right.
You know, I don't know. But at some point in time, you do, right?
Well, yeah, you absolutely do. And for no other reason. And this is why I think I get a little nervous about this. And, you know, we've said how many times you had this blue wave. You had a whole bunch of people who felt very motivated to give you the gavel, to give you the position you're in. Now, maybe they didn't do it, and I'm going out on a limb by saying that most of the people didn't look at it like, we're going to give Nancy Pelosi the gavel, or we're going to make Jerry Nadler the chair, or whatever. They just wanted the people who were there now. They got tired of their shit and wanted them out. Okay?
Right.
At what point does this enthusiasm, this strength, and all this wave that you're riding start to diminish because you're not moving at a pace that these people think you should be moving at? And even if you're doing it the right way, don't you think that you should, again, you know, the biggest problem the Democrats have is they cannot put a message forth to save their lives. Don't you have to start telling these people, look, we understand, we know what you're doing, we understand what you want, just trust us, you know, this is the way we have to do it. And even give them reasons why, you know, be, and I don't mean that, you know, that shallow, just, you know, like that, because then you're just patronizing people. Right. Yeah, you know what I'm saying, though?
Yeah.
I think they're doing a really poor job of that.
Yeah, the messaging is definitely, you know, we talked about this last week, too. The messaging is poor. The messaging is very poor. And, you know, there are people who are clearly supporters of a progressive agenda, that are clearly have given their money, have given their time, have given their resources, their effort to help. And, you know, there's also just the American public in general, too. And you would think that the leadership would say, you know, there's 55% of the people who are not approving of President Trump's job. His job approval rating is hovering around, disapproval is hovering around 55%. Well, what are we doing about that?
Right.
What are we doing?
Right. And, you know, you got to do more than just point out his faults. You got to show your strengths, right? Because it's easy to point the finger at something. That's very shallow. I always thought that the one problem that Barack Obama had, and this is going to sound really, really, really mean, and there's no other way to put it. He always assumed that everybody around him had at least the same remedial knowledge of the subject that he did.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a big problem for him, and something that he never really conquered that problem, right? Because he just, even today, whenever you see him today, and you hear, you know, you see him on stage talking about whatever it is he's talking about, he still has that same opinion. And, you know, it's not a bad thing. Like, it's not a bad reflection upon him or his character, because he's assuming that he's not the smartest person in the room. Right. So that says a lot. But you know, whenever I talk to my drafters, I always tell them the same thing. I say, always make these plans like an idiot is looking at them.
Yeah.
Okay. Because no one will look at everything or understand everything the same way you do. So always be redundant. You know, even if you think it's not important, it very well could be. It's just you don't see that. The Democrats have a big problem in that they assume that, as individuals, the entire party looks at things the same way they do. And you can't make that assumption, or maybe not look at it, but understand it the same way they do, or understand it as much as or as well as they do. And whenever you have such a diverse party, whenever you have so many people from so many backgrounds and so many, you know, such huge and incredible histories, that doesn't work. And the Democrats have yet to get over that and figure out a way to start communicating better. They just have a very, very poor time doing that. And it's killing them. And it's going to killing them now whenever you're going up against somebody who looks at everything like it's a source of entertainment, right? And knows how to dummy everything down so that the person, you know, who shops at Walmart every day can understand it.
That's right. And that's exactly right. We talked about this last week as well, where, you know, I mentioned, like, there's a political strategy and there's a, you know, a legal and ethical strategy. And it sometimes angers my parents when I say, if you really want to win politically, you want to beat this guy politically, you have to kind of tell people what they want to hear. And you have to do it in these short sound bites. And you have to do it in a way, regardless of whether you think you can actually provide that, you say it because that's what people want to hear. So, right. And, you know, to your point, this is just to hammer home what you just said. The New York Times, and at one time, and maybe even today, the, you know, print newspapers have changed a little bit, but even maybe today, the New York Times is thought of as one of the premier written pieces of journalism that comes out every day. It's high journalism, and, you know, what folks consider to be one of the best journalistic endeavors from a daily newspaper. Their vocabulary that they use in the New York Times averages about 600 words in English. They repeat the same 600 words. Okay. So They're writing to an audience that they understand basically is going to understand those 600 words. Okay. They may introduce a new word here and there, but they're generally not writing with words that you have to have an advanced degree to understand, or that you have to go to your dictionary to understand. So they understand that to consume what they write, it has to be at that level, because nobody has time to read and then go back to the dictionary and try to figure out the context of what they said. So that's a messaging thing. And they're pros at messaging. Okay. And then, you know, secondly, we also have, you know, we were told when we would work within the public interest sector, when you're writing something, even for the legislators that are hearing your request to do something on a law, a piece of legislation, their aides are going to read it, the legislators are going to read it, but you should write it. And this is also New York Times. I think they write everything at a fifth grade level. You should write it like you're talking to a fifth grade. Now, there are a lot of smart fifth graders. Believe me, I'm not saying, you know, my son's in third grade and he amazes me every day with, you know, he blows me away with this. But I mean, and there's a lot of smart fifth graders, but you write it at a fifth grade level so that it's just easy to digest. Not because they couldn't understand beyond a fifth grade level. Clearly they can, but it just makes it easier. The message is easier to digest. It doesn't take as much time. And this is the point. We don't have time to win people over with these long dissertations and arguing about every X detail and nth detail. You've got to get to the point. You've got to get to the heart of the matter. What do people want? You know, overwhelmingly, the majority of the public is angry with Trump, and they're angry with him not being held accountable. That's clear. So you've got to tell them, here's what we're going to do about that. And not only are we going to do that, but once we get power back, we're going to do this to improve your lot in life.
Yeah, that's brilliant. You can't, and you know, it's not that people aren't smart. I think, well, I've always said a person is smart, people are stupid. But people don't have time, okay? And their lives are just too hectic, right? They got too much going on. There's too many things that are pulling them in too many different directions. And it's not a matter of you know, we're going to dumb this down because we think you're stupid. It's because we got to dumb this down and hit you with something that you're going to retain and hold on to, and something that you're going to understand. And then, you know, go on with your day. You know, go pick the kids up at soccer practice and, you know, do whatever it is what else you got to do. So I really think that the Democrats missed the point there. And you would think that would be right in their wheelhouse. But for whatever reason, they don't seem to get that. And that's unfortunate, because messaging means a lot. Trump tells you, Trump's the greatest example of that you'll ever see. Messaging means a lot. And you're absolutely right. It almost doesn't even matter if there's even an iota of truth to it, right? It's not the message as much as it is how you deliver that message. That's what it's about. And he does that for his 40%, he does it better than anybody I've ever seen, because these people will jump off cliffs for him. You know, so he got that down.
Well, you know, the evil that Hitler wrought upon this world, the evil things that he did and wanted to do, when you look back through the lens of history, you say, how could people follow him? How could people actually jump on board and rant and rave at his rallies and get so excited about him when you think about all the stuff that he wanted to do and in fact did do, had done in his name and during his reign? And it's the message, the way he delivered the message, the way he empowered people who felt downtrodden. There was a speaking style. There was a pausing, a halting, a building, a crescendo. There was, you know, fire and anger sometimes in his voice. And he was a master communicator in that way. And he knew how to communicate to folks who were downtrodden. And Trump studied this. You know, he studied this method. And you know, it's not his only method, but he knows that that's a method that worked. And he does the same thing.
Yeah, he does. And just to hammer that point home a little bit, or a lot, he spent already, he has spent $6 million advertising only on Facebook. That's it. That $6 million was simply for Facebook. So he knows what his target audience is. I think where he's going to screw up is his target audience is capping at 40%. But that he knows where they are, he knows what to say to them, and he knows how to say it to them. And that's, you know, let's be honest, that's going to serve him well. It's just that I'm hoping and I'm praying that the numbers that he needs in order to pull this off aren't going to be there. But he's right. He's doing it just right.
Yeah, he is. He absolutely is. Now, you brought up a point. You brought up something that I know you are very frustrated and angry, and you do not like a company by the name of Facebook.
Yeah.
And I understand that. and I understand that. I get it. And I think that there's superior good reasoning behind not liking them. And, you know, one example is they recently, well, obviously, you know, we know that they were either a willing or an unwilling participant in the fleecing and fooling of America with this disinformation campaign that was undertaken by the Russian trolls, the GRU, the Internet Research Agency in Moscow, 100 people whose job it was to send a public disinformation campaign to influence our election. And they used Facebook as one of their big mediums. Well, so Facebook knows that they were used in that way. And then they continue to allow themselves to be used that way. Recently, there was a video that was proven to be false about Nancy Pelosi, and folks asked them to take it down because it was false. And Facebook refused, right?
Right.
They refused to take it down. So, you know, here we have this publicly traded company that is acting in a less than desirable way, I think would be a best way to say it. Now, here's where I think the rubber meets the road. When you talk about how to get change in something like that, you can argue that I'm going to disconnect from Facebook and I'm going to stop using it. And I think that's great. And if you get everybody else to stop using it, that would send a message because they would see a lack of traffic on their site to the point where it would have an impact, because now they're about advertising. They're about utilizing the information that they have about people to help sell to advertising. And that's how they get a large amount of revenue. The other way that I think is a possible way to influence this is, look, there are a lot of folks who are shareholders in Facebook who are not, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, and who are not, you know, the top people. Now, they have a lot of shares. There's no doubt. But if there are folks that have shares, you have a voice because you have a shareholder meeting. And it doesn't matter if you have one share, 10 shares, 100 shares, you have a vote. You have a voice. You can go to that shareholder meeting And you can say, I don't approve of the way the board is handling this. I don't approve of this company allowing this information out there. Now, could it change in one shareholder meeting? Probably not. But if you just turn around and set, let's take away from the idea of not connecting to Facebook, but just the money aspect. Let's say you had shares in Facebook and you decided that you were going to talk to other shareholders, which is easy enough to do. And you said, look, I see this company as potentially being harmed because, look, this week alone, there is a company by the name of Okta, who is an internet-based company, and they've grown their profits from like $28 a share to $129 a share in the course of a year or less. Meanwhile, Facebook has lost share revenue right now. Okay, so what talks to people? What speaks to people? Money.
Money.
Profits. Yeah, profits. So if you said to the other shareholders, look, this is bound to continue to impact us. There's going to be a negative impact on the profit if this continues down this road. So let's have a voice in this and tell them we don't approve of handling things this way. It's got to change. And when they see shareholders take that kind of interest, it actually has, you know, it has merit because you're actually part of the structure of the company then. You're not, you know, a decision maker, but they are accountable to you. They have to be accountable to you. Shareholders have rights. They have rights that they can enforce through lawsuits. And that's something that Facebook doesn't want.
Well, you bring up a couple good points. My argument against that will be, though, I can't tell you how many people will sit there and say, and I promise you, you've heard this statement or something very close to it. Yeah, I really hate Facebook, but that's the only way I can keep up with my family, or I can keep up with, you know, my people I went to college with, or I can, you know, whatever the case may be. I hate it, but it's always right. I hate it, but, and I always make the argument of, if you want to keep up with your family, text them.
Right.
Right. Send them a picture. Okay, here's little Joey's, you know, I don't know, communion outfit. You know, boom, here it is. So there are ways around it. It's just too convenient to stay there. As much as people hate it, it's just too convenient.
And that's why themselves a part of the fabric of our society at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And people are willing to give up a whole lot for that convenience. And they're willing to put up with a lot for that convenience. People allow themselves to become the product just so they can see what little Joey or little Susie's doing, or just to see the next cat picture, right? They're willing to do that. And so this idea that people are going to change this thing, I don't see that happening. They've given up the ability to do that a long time, or willingly gave it up a long time ago. They're more than happy to jump through any hoop they have to jump through, and be sold time and time and time again, just so they can see little Susie or Joey's pictures.
I agree. That's the user of Facebook. That's the end user of Facebook.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's going to change. But I think that people who see their share price drop, and it is dropping right now because I watch it, it drops significantly. I mean, if you invested in Facebook in the last 6 months, 9 months, you've lost money.
You lost money. Wow. Okay. I must have misunderstood you then. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, you've lost money. If you bought it within the last 9 months, you've lost money. So that shareholder has some motivation.
No, you're absolutely right. Now, I must have misunderstood what you were saying. Do you think, if that's the case, then don't you think that they're eventually, like, all these safeguards that they said they put in place so misinformation is harder to come by? We mentioned the Pelosi video a little bit ago. You know, an easy way to solve that is just make sure that. And I said this with Master Grant, I think 2 weeks ago when Dr. Dye was on with us. I said, why not just any video that's put up on Facebook has to be categorized? Okay, that's it. It cannot, you know, so this video cannot be put up, and if you put it up as news, it gets rejected, right? Because right. But you put it up as parody, it's accepted.
Right.
Okay, so everybody who watches that video can look at it and look down in a little corner and say, oh, it's a parody thing. Okay, it's not real. Right? Facebook could very easily solve problems by doing things like that. I'm not saying to do that exactly, but that go that direction, go that route. You know, let that be the starting point and then figure out how you want to do it. They're simply not. So what's to stop these folks now, whenever their share prices continue to plummet, to take even the rudimentary safeguards that they just put in place and just start ignoring them in order to get that stereotypical, that Russian money, you know? What's to stop them from doing that now?
Nothing. I mean, other than, you know, mm-hmm. other than a shareholder revolt or litigation, I mean, that'd be about it.
And do you think that's likely? If all of a sudden let's be a bit naive. The $100 I invested this week or this month is not worth $150. Do you think people are going to do that?
No.
No, I don't either. No chance.
Why we have to write things at a fifth grade level. Because right. everybody's too busy. They're too busy right. with their own lives, too busy with other things that are occupying their time. And I understand that.
Yep. Yeah. And that's where you have your problem. To break from what we were going to talk about here for just a second, some breaking news. I like doing breaking news. We should do that all the time. Breaking news, right? We'll pretend we're Wolf Blitzer. Okay, breaking news. Hope Hicks agrees to give closed door testimony to House panel.
Wow.
I found that a little interesting too. Apparently this just happened, like literally within the last, let's say hour or so. Okay. Frank, in your opinion, these closed door testimonies, do you think that, well, what weight do you think they carry as opposed to public? And do you think, at the end of the day, it serves much of a purpose?
I mean, as far as the weight goes, I would say the weight is to Congress is going to be the same. You know what I mean? Because whether they're testifying openly or in closed session, they're still providing their testimony. So the weight is going to be the same to them. But the effect, the bigger effect, the public relations effect and all that. I mean, it's again controlling the message by the Republican Party or the Trump, you know, cartel, whatever you want to call it. You know, they're controlling the message, because bottom line is they're saying, look, the only way we're going to testify is if it's in this fashion. And then they can spin it afterwards however they want to, because even when you see something in black and white, even if you've seen a video of something, you know, this party is telling you not to believe your eyes and your ears. So if you don't see it and hear it firsthand, they're just going to tell you not to believe it. You know, so even if she goes out and says something that's damning to the president in this closed door session, he'll just claim it's a lie. He'll claim that she never said that.
Right. And yeah, it allows the Congress people from both sides information that they should have. Okay. But if you don't know the information that I know, or you don't know that I have that information, I can pretty much tell you whatever happened. And whether I have that information or not, I don't have any motivation to actually act on it other than, okay, I want to actually be a patriot and care for my country first, which these people have shown from time and time again that they just don't want to do. I guess my more specific question is, do you think it's going to have any impact on these folks' decisions? Because it's a closed-door testimony and no one else knows about it other than the people in that room, do you think that is really going to force certain members of Congress to start acting differently or start taking a different approach to this, or you know my question?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. And I guess my answer to that is it's a cumulative effect. It's probably not going to be one person's testimony. But when you take things into a cumulative effect, you look at a, 400 something page report from Mueller, you start asking questions of the Deutsche Bank people, you start asking questions of HOPIX, you start asking questions of, Donald Trump Jr. again, whatever you do, there's a cumulative effect to that. So I do believe that the cumulative effect will impact decision making. I don't know to what degree and what the timeline of that will be, but I think that's the only way it impacts it, is when you start talking cumulatively.
You think eventually it's going to pay off?
Yes.
Well, maybe payoff's not the good word, not a good way to put it. But you think eventually people are going to start making proper decisions?
Yeah, I think it'll enlighten or it'll give them the opportunity to put a path forward by having this information.
Okay. All right. That, well, I wonder, I think you're right. I think ultimately you're right. I guess my biggest question, then it's just a very, and of course it's very hypothetical, but I wonder if it's going to be enough actual numbers wise to see a change in how, certain people or certain people in certain bodies actually do things.
Well, let me ask you this. Is the information available on the article that you just saw this on as to which committee will hold a closed door hearing? And do we know who's on that committee? Because, I'm thinking that's a hypothetical question at this point in time, because it probably, like you said, breaking news, there's probably not a lot of detail to it, right?
Yeah. It popped up on my iPad. It's the Wall Street Journal who's doing that. I'm kind of looking at CNN right now too, just to see. I will bet you serious money that it's in the House, right? Because the Republican controlled Senate doesn't want to hear from her. Right.
Right.
As to which committee in the House, that's a good question. I mean, it's got to be either Nadler's or House panel votes to hold AG Barr and Secretary Ross in contempt. Well, there you go. All right. So that's Barr's, right?
Yeah. So
so
that was something I was thinking was going to happen. And, you never know, but I kind of felt like Nadler and those folks were going to follow through with that. I really did.
Oh, here's another. You know what? I saw this earlier and I wanted to ask you that. I know we're going way off script. I'm really sorry. Trump exerts executive privilege over census documents. Can he actually get away with that? Is that something do you think he can do? Because I didn't think he had much control over the Census Bureau.
Well, you know what this is, okay? So there was some internal communique. There was an email, a bunch of emails on the server at the White House from a guy who's now deceased. And he was the one that was the architect behind the idea of adding the question on the census about what the ethnicity or where they're from or something. There's a demographic question they want to add, right? Mm-hmm. And what their status is, immigration status, I think was what it was. So in his emails, there's supposedly the reasoning why he wants this added was that it will have a chilling effect on people even answering the census. They won't give the account of who's in the house. They won't say that there's five people in the house if there's somebody that's not illegal, if there's somebody waiting a visa or waiting for status, they won't report them, because there's a fear. And he knows this. So in this email, it goes through this detail of why there are people that would be afraid to even report themselves, and that the numbers in certain areas will go down. And if the numbers in those areas are going to affect the Democrats disproportionately to the Republicans, because those are Democratic strongholds, and that when the numbers go down in those areas, it'll help the gerrymandering efforts. It'll help bring electoral college numbers down in certain states. It'll just generally help the Republicans in national elections. So this is the reason why they want to add that to the census question. And what he's asserting privilege over is the content in that email. People want to see what's in that email so that they can say that this is for an illegal purpose, that you're putting this on the census. And he's hiding it. He doesn't want anybody to see it because there's a nefarious reason for putting this on the census.
Well, then your opinion, just yes or no, is he going to be able to get away with exerting executive privilege over this?
Wow.
I know it's tough, so, right? I know, yeah. But
I mean, my question is this, I don't have the answer to it, but if the email was sent to somebody other than the White House, if somebody else received that email intentionally, not unintentionally, but if intentionally somebody else was copied on that, then my answer would be no. He will not be able to assert the privilege.
Simply because of the third party, right?
Right, right.
Okay.
Because it was disclosed by the sender to a third party intentionally. Now, if on the other hand, it was only sent, prepared and sent to the White House for purposes of designing a strategy around how the census should be conducted, what questions should be included on the census, I think he might, as sad as this is, and as far as I don't want to pine this way, I think he might have a legitimate claim to assert privilege on that, because it's prepared specifically for his eyes. So, you know, if that's the case, he may have a right to assert privilege. Now, there's a gray area. I said, if that sender intentionally sent it to some third party, I don't think he could assert privilege. What if there was an unintentional sending to a third party? That's a gray area. And the courts, I think, would have they'd have to grapple with a question as to whether or not, because it's like a search, right? When you have a police search, mm-hmm. and you uncover information, but you did it without a warrant, and you did it without extenuating circumstances, the courts can exclude that evidence from coming into a hearing. Well, but there are some times where you can say, well, I discovered this. It wasn't because I didn't, you know, I broke into the house and didn't have a warrant, but, you know, there was a fire in the house, and in order to save somebody's life inside there, I had to go in. And when I went in plain view was this piece of damning evidence against the resident of that house.
Yeah. This is what I saw. Yeah.
So, you know, you can analogize that to like, what if, you know, there was a dump of emails that the White House sent off to a bunch of people, and this was accidentally included in the dump of emails. Right. And they're like, wait a minute, what's this? Oh, this is all part of this. Okay. Oh, gee, this is interesting information. I didn't try to break into the server to get it, but look, it just fell into our laps.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? It's important that you kind of explain this to people, right? Because I promise you there's going to be a whole bunch of people that whenever they see this thing and they see, wait a minute, it's the census. What the hell does the president have to do with the census, right? People are going to get confused and you know, one side's going to overgo one way and the other side's going to overgo the other way. And it's going to get convoluted and it's going to get to the point where, but like a bunch of other things, people just hear too much about it from one side or the other. They just don't want to hear it anymore.
Right.
You know? And that goes back to what we said earlier about having quick little sound bites, the quick little things where Trump is brilliant at. Hopefully, you know, we'll see what happens with this. If the House Democrats decide that they're going to pursue this information and try to challenge his executive privilege, I'll be real interested to see if they're doing this like just a grandstand or if they actually have sound, you know, a sound foundation to stand on. It's going to be something to see if they even try. So, you know, we'll see where that goes. It's way too early because we just found out about this. It's way too early to see, to get anybody's, you know, who we think kind of knows what's going on. It's way too early to I don't think they've given their opinions yet.
Right. One thing I want to say before I know we're going to wrap up, it's kind of putting a bow on some of the stuff we've talked about with the sound bites and the idea that, you know, Trump is a master communicator. And I think, notwithstanding the fact that I agree with that assessment, I share that assessment with you. I think he's a master communicator and he studied that communication format. Mm-hmm. He has his shortcomings, even in communication. And his shortcomings a lot of times are this. He doesn't read. He doesn't take time to get in depth with things, but he loves to hear himself talk. He loves to hold court. He loves to have an mm-hmm. audience. He's very much a narcissist, right? So he wants mm-hmm. to continue to talk to people, see people in front of him who care about hearing what he has to say. So just like any other, you know, suspect, and he's kind of a suspect at this point in time with regard to whether he should be impeached or indicted at some point in time because of the crimes that potentially were committed by him.
Well, he is an unindicted co-conspirator in at least right. one hush money payment.
That's right. So any suspect or any potential, you know, person in a criminal investigation, one of the rules of the investigators is to get them talking, to keep them talking. And his downfall in some ways is that once he starts with the diarrhea of the mouth and starts talking, he gets into gibberish and nonsense, and he doesn't make sense of a lot of things. And he just starts to ramble. And as he gets a little older, he starts to sound more incoherent. And as he gets tired, he gets more incoherent. And this is a guy who just doesn't have the patience to restrain himself a lot of times. And one of the funniest things I saw recently was on Fox News, they actually cut away from him. Now, when do you see Fox News or any other news agency have the president live on TV, and then while he's speaking mid-sentence, they cut away for no reason?
Yeah. That's telling, isn't it?
Right? Yeah. He was sitting there saying something to the effect that, you know, the farmers in Iowa have been neglected by the broadband companies, and you all have these, you know, tractors in the field, and they don't communicate with the computers, and you've been left behind, and you're sadly and sorely in need of this, and the tractors, they want to communicate. And Fox people were just kind of like, oh, my God, we got to get away. We got to take a break. It was just because like he was insulting them, and he was also talking gibberish. He's like, you've been left behind. Well, wait a minute. I guarantee you that if you live in Iowa, you live in Minnesota, you live in, you know, in America, anywhere for the most part, maybe in some remote parts of Alaska and remote parts of Hawaii and remote parts of certain, you know, areas, far northern reaches, far, you know, you might have some difficulty accessing internet, but I mean, 98 to 99% coverage, right? There is coverage out there. And it's insulting to say, like, what do you think? They're just living with blackboards and they're using abacuses in Iowa that they don't have the ability to connect to the internet. Come on, man.
Well, you know, I always said the one thing that he has done to all of his supporters that they don't even realize that he's done is he makes it very apparent that he assumes they're idiots.
Yeah.
Right. He really does. He assumes that they're fools, and they're just, well, so many, 4 out of 10, which I can't believe that number is that high, is just so willing to go along with them. It's sad. It really is. Okay, Frank, I think we're gonna call it a day, or a week, I should say. Any final words before we put a noose around this thing and kick the chair out from under it?
Just stay vigilant, people. You know, keep your eyes on the prize. I'm going to use my little sound bites now. I went into deep. Ask, you know what I'm talking about? You know.
Yep.
Keep your eyes on the prize. All right.
Absolutely. Okay, and to all of our listeners, thank you again. You know, like we say every Wednesday and every Sunday, your time is very valuable, and the fact that you're willing to spend some of that time with us really means a great deal to us. It truly does. You have no idea how excited we are whenever we see the numbers and people are actually listening to what these two fools have to say. So until next week, Frank, and to everybody, to you and to all of our male listeners, almost all of our male listeners, have a happy Father's Day this Sunday, and we'll talk to we'll talk to everybody next week. Okay. Goodbye. Good luck and God bless.
Butchered Sports. Raw and unfiltered, the way you wish your local sports anchor would bring it to you. Find us on Twitter at Butchered Sports and on YouTube at Butchered Sports. Make sure to like, comment, and subscribe.
Thanks for listening to Holy Sh*t with Frank and Master Patsy. If you like our show, please subscribe and leave us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to support us on Patreon. Join us again next week when we discuss the next thing that made us say, holy shit.